frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 10th, 2016, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Jonathan, Kelly, and Greg join me to discuss the failure of the Columbia Peace Deal referendum and what lessons we should draw from it for issues of direct democracy and American foreign policy more broadly. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week again is Jonathan Cohn. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
And on the line from Virginia is Greg. Hi, Greg.
Hey, everybody.
So we're going to talk about the situation in Colombia and sort of some of the broader foreign policy implications for that. Some of the listeners of our show, especially the newer listeners, may also be listeners to a show called the Chapo Trap House podcast. And I would just note that, like, they did an excellent show entirely or pretty much entirely on the Colombia situation. And so folks might want to check out that because they had an actual, like, area expert on to talk about that and also the broader foreign policy implications. But we have talked about Colombia previously on the show and the peace deal there that was still being negotiated the last time that we had had a discussion about it. And Kelly had sort of led that discussion and also written a couple posts or maybe one post on arsenalfordemocracy.com, our blog, to talk about that situation. And so we wanted to kind of go over what's happened since then, which was not great, and what that may mean going forward and sort of what the U.S. role is there. So, Kelly, could you sort of re-summarize what this peace deal was all about and also bring us up to date on what just happened?
Yeah, of course. So I think last time we talked, which was more than a year ago, I was cautiously hopeful that the peace deals that were happening in Havana, Cuba, between FARC, which is the guerrilla group, and the Colombian government, were going to produce a peace deal, which would be really incredible for the Colombians who have been living for decades with this armed guerrilla group. And also the government has responded with quite a bit of might to this armed guerrilla group, which has resulted in deaths on every side, lots of citizens killed between these two warring factions. Honestly, hard to imagine what it would be like to live there and sort of be at war with your own government and also at war with this group. So there was a peace talk that came out of Havana, and both sides were hopeful that this was going to be it. It was going to be the end of a conflict, which began in 1964. And then the Colombian people got an opportunity to vote on the deal. By one half of 1%, the Colombian people rejected the deal. Then shortly afterwards, the president of Colombia was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for the deal, which is no longer valid because the Colombian people have rejected it. So in just a few short days, there's a lot of happenings in a war that's lasted 40 years. So the question now is what next? And also I think it's going to be important to dissect why the Colombian people rejected this deal. Lots of theories. One interesting thing is that people who rejected the deal far and away weren't from areas being affected by the conflict. A lot of people use this deal, vote no, for their own agenda, saying just crazy, crazy things, that they were trying to take people's land or impose a new gender norms. I mean, I read some really ridiculous things about what the no people were trying to sell, and unfortunately they sold it. So just like we saw in Brexit, now it's the question of they got their way, so what happens next? What's the alternative to this peace deal? How do you respect the will of the people and their vote, also move the country forward and stop this conflict?
I definitely am going to want to circle back at some point in this discussion to the Brexit parallel that you brought up. But yeah, you know, a lot of great points that you've raised. Certainly there seemed to be a division in terms of the geography of where the yes and no votes predominantly came from. The people rejecting it, as you mentioned, tended to be in the areas that weren't directly affected as heavily, which I think probably means that the people in those areas were just like, all right, this has been going on for 50 years and we're kind of exhausted. Let's just be done with it and get a peace deal. That, I think, is a reasonable position for those people to have. And maybe if you weren't as closely affected by the violence, you might be a little bit more willing to, I guess, just keep it going because it didn't really affect you one way or the other. It didn't mean your life was going to change meaningfully in a positive or negative direction. And it's sort of, I guess, abstract if you're like not as directly affected, because then you can be more like picky about the details of the deal, because it doesn't mean anything to you in the bigger picture. There are sort of like domestic factors, international factors, and I want to talk about both of those. I will also note, because, you know, Kelly mentioned that the margin that no won by, despite polling that was perhaps a little bit off, suggesting that it had like 2/3 public approval or something, and then it, you know, failing by 0.5%. What appears to have been the decisive factor, and I think Julia Carmel had posted some stats on Twitter. She is of Colombian heritage. She posted like showing that the areas that were hardest hit by Hurricane Matthew were like that those areas would have voted yes in a greater proportion than, say, the national average, and their turnout was significantly reduced due to, like, evacuations or just inability to get to the polls because it was pouring rain.
Do you remember what the turnout numbers were? Because I was just thinking of the same thing as well.
It was 37%. 37% of the 34 million people that live in Colombia came out. And so I think that the actual margin of victory was only about 54,000 votes.
Right. That, you know, and that's pretty small. I mean, that also suggests some sort of problems with the turnout itself in general. That, like, because in a lot of countries, this actually just happened in Hungary, fortunately, in that case. They had a referendum on refugees. It was very hostile to refugees. And it failed. It passed, but did not have enough. There's like a percentage requirement there where you have to get a certain percentage turnout in order for it to be valid. And it did not hit that target. And like this one in Colombia, even if it had been a little bit more, like would have similarly probably only gotten to like 40% or something, I'm guessing. You know, so hurricane, you can't do much about that. That's unfortunate. You can't do much about that. More problematically, Jonathan, I think you had tweeted out an article about this maybe, that there seems to be some growing ties between the sort of like Christian right that's no doubt fostered by the United States and like the no campaign in Colombia.
Yeah, it was kind of related to something Kelly was just noting about. It was an article that was talking about the backlash to the liberalization kind of around things like homosexuality and gender roles, etc., happening in Colombia, that people that the no side was building on that backlash and kind of harnessing it to their ends. It to some extent made me think of the campaign, the kind of impeachment vote against Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, where some of the things that people like used as their case against her had absolutely nothing to do with constitutional grounds. And one of them was like, "I'm voting to impeach Dilma because they're teaching sex ed in public schools now."
Yeah, well, and this is something that we've seen, like, for sure in sub-Saharan Africa, is a lot of interference by the U.S. evangelical movement in terms of promoting a much more hardline agenda than is, we'll say, indigenous to Africa. Like, it's been very prominent in Uganda, for example, because there was this, the so-called Kill the Gays bill, which we've talked about previously on the show, and the U.S. provides a tremendous amount of military resources to the regime in Uganda. But it has happened in a whole bunch of other countries as well across Africa. And I know there's been various, like, turmoil in Nigeria, I think. Obviously not turmoil on the way that the actual war there has been turmoil, but in terms of political turmoil because of this, like, growing, US supported, like, hardliner social conservative position. And I know that this is not, like, new for Latin America. I think usually it's been sort of Catholic to Catholic ties. But I know also, like, I don't know the details that well in Colombia, but I know in Latin America in general, there's been sort of a rising evangelical movement in Latin America that's not part of the Catholic Church, various, like, Adventists and things like that as well. And so there's sort of this religious transition occurring there that, unlike in the US, where it's transitioning sort of away from religion, it's like reallocation within Latin America of, like, the share of the population that belongs to various sects. But yeah, this sort of, like, backlash being, like, co-engineered by, like, US supported evangelicals and, like, saying, making these extreme claims regarding gender or whatever. And as you mentioned, also, we're seeing similar patterns in Brazil. So that's something, like, I think we have to keep an eye on more. And I think we're only just now getting to the point in the sort of US political consensus, leaving aside the dead-ender Republicans, obviously. But, like, a few years ago, definitely 10 years ago, but even 5 years ago, probably, I don't think there would be a consensus to even have the position that that was, like, wrong, right? Because, like, we didn't even have support for, like, marriage equality among most, like, Democratic senators or members of Congress, like, that kind of thing, even, 6 years ago.
Yeah, it happened. It was a fascinating thing to watch because when it started to happen, it was kind of like it like opening the floodgates. It just happened very, very fast, particularly driven by the Supreme Court case as well as state level initiatives. Where suddenly, when like senators, representatives were being put on the spot and asked, and there was a broader political context, then suddenly people started supporting it, even though they'd hedged or opposed it for a long time.
Right. So, like, my hope is that we'll start seeing a policy shift where the, State Department or whatever is, like, putting more pressure on saying, like, hey, you can't be going and advocating. I mean, we have in Massachusetts that guy Scott Lively, who ran for governor as an independent to in 2014, but that dude openly promotes genocide against gay people, was a major force in the situation in Uganda. He says horribly vile, like, hate speech all the time, goes and organizes these sort of international missions. At a certain point, we don't allow people to do that for terrorist groups.
Yeah.
Certainly not so-called Islamic terrorism. That seems to be in a completely different category from almost anything else in terms of US policy. But in the recent past, I don't think there was any political will to say, hey, you can't be doing that. The other problem, of course, being that I don't know that there would be political will to do anything one way or the other in Colombia, because we have this war on drugs relationship that's been very toxic for a long time and very, like, militarized. And you get those, I don't know if it's Max Boot himself, but the Max Boot types of the world who are always, like, writing articles and doing TV segments about how great the US, like, military operations in Colombia are, and, like, that they're such a good example of what, US military power can do.
And didn't Clinton cite that as a positive, that, like, was it playing Colombia as, like, a positive example of
Yeah, and I think most
foreign policy?
people, who, I mean, unless you're all rah-rah paramilitaries, anti-FARC or whatever, I don't think you agree with that if you know anything about the situation or are Colombian.
Here's one question for people new to the situation. Kelly, can you give us a little background about how the conflict started in the first place?
Do you have the answer? You might be able to do a better job. I get
I don't, does anyone remember how it
I
started? I don't
actually
know.
don't.
It has essentially to do with the illicit drug trade. So go back to America's drug problem, essentially. And I think that this group, this FARC group, gained so much power and money and influence that they were able to challenge the government. And the militant government obviously didn't like that. And it is one of those situations where it's gone on for decades now. I think that the original roots of the problem have gotten lost in the, as time has passed. But at the end of the day, neither of these actors wants to leave this peace talk powerless. Everybody wants to look like a winner, which is why many Colombians were upset that these FARC leaders weren't going to face jail time, despite the fact that they were obvious criminals. But that was sort of FARC's way out of it.
My understanding is that, like Kelly said, the original causes kind of got lost a long time ago. There was various like land reform type or lack thereof issues like we saw all across Latin America. You had military units allegedly attacking peasants or whatever, probably extorting them. And then this leads to this sort of like rural backlash movement that becomes FARC. It's like, communist aligned or whatever. And then you end up with these right-wing paramilitaries that are formed in response to that. And it's sort of this escalating cycle. But then the drug situation turns into a much bigger factor. This is not by any means unique to FARC in terms of groups, insurgent groups eventually taking on a role in the drug trade as a revenue stream. And then, this just kept on going around and around and around for 50 years. And any conflict that goes on for 50 years is eventually going to probably lose its sort of like origins and ideological characteristics, because it's just a question of like, well, neither side can really win this by force, and we're just gonna like keep it going and see. I want to go to Greg now, because Greg, what were you going
to
say?
Yeah, just to like go off of Kelly's point too, that there were Colombians that were frustrated that FARC wasn't going to face any sort of justice for the war crimes that they committed, and at the same token, that the Colombian military was also not going to face any sort of justice. This has sort of been the MO for all of these reconciliation processes, though. And the Chapo Trap House podcast does, I think, a really good discussion of this sort of idea of rule of law versus
political reality.
Right, exactly. And how it would be nice if we could come to a resolution and come to peace and all of the bad actors would actually face justice. But as we have seen so often, I think most saliently in perhaps in South Africa, that these processes are sort of contingent upon impunity for the bad actors, because that's one of the only reasons that they would stop fighting in the first place. Because if you stop fighting and there's peace, and then you're also subject to justice for every bad thing that you did during the Civil War, then what incentive do you have to stop fighting? Your incentive would be to fight until you can win and install a political power structure that would not serve justice for the crimes that you have committed. And so this is Human Rights Watch coming out against this. I think that the political reality versus the rule of law is a really good sort of thing to keep in mind here, that as much as it would be nice to put a bow on this and that everybody that did something wrong during the 52 years of the Civil War would be brought to justice, it's just, it doesn't really seem possible. And the more important thing is that people stop moving forward. Not so much what they did in the past. It's more important that they stop moving forward.
Sure. And yeah, and my mother was talking to someone who was a political sort of refugee or whatever from Colombia, and that guy, his father had been killed by FARC, so he was saying, oh, this is a terrible deal that's, giving, and sure, the reality is that a lot of people with direct exposure like that are probably going to be very frustrated with a deal like this. But then there are the people whose lives are just constantly disrupted and everything is left without resolution. And that you have to sort of balance it at a certain point. And this unwillingness to balance it was a problem. But also, there was all this emphasis on the crimes by FARC and not on the right-wing paramilitaries, who were very often over the 50-year period extensively funded and supported by the CIA or the United States government, even the State Department sometimes. And if you're going to just go and say, oh, FARC is bad and should not get any amnesty or any political benefits or anything like that, and you're going to say that, but you're not going to talk about the fact that more of the people killed were killed by paramilitaries formed in response to FARC, I mean, that's just dishonest. But yeah, I mean, this, like, there's the examples of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that we see in various countries like Rwanda or South Africa. There's also just the example of all these, like, military leaders and strongmen across Africa, North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa, who, if they have an option, if they realize they're going down, and they have an option to get on a helicopter, get to the airport, and go to, like, Saudi Arabia and live out the rest of their days or whatever, that's not justice. But it gets them out. Idi Amin, he never got killed or anything. Like, he just went and lived out the rest of his days in Saudi Arabia. And you can talk about, well, that's horrible for all the people that he oppressed. But if the alternative, and this happens in many other cases, is that they don't get on that helicopter and they decide to try to kill everyone, as, you know, until they get killed, like, that's not productive either. And I think we saw this most starkly in the situation with Gaddafi. People framed Gaddafi always as this madman or whatever, but I am guessing that it is probably likely that at a certain point he realized, oh, I'm going down, but I have nowhere to go. The whole Arab League, including Saudi Arabia, authorized that military intervention against him, so he wasn't going to get any support there, and everyone else was hostile to him, and everyone was talking about, you know, sending him to the ICC or whatever for international prosecution. And that's the problem. They keep on, there's this cadre of people, and again, that's also discussed more on the Chapo Trap House thing. There's this cadre of, like, international human rights lawyers who seem obsessed with the idea of getting justice rather than, we need to resolve this situation before more people get killed.
Well, I would put, like, an asterisk in terms of a lot of these people don't care so much about achieving justice when the U.S. is the perpetrator of things. I'm just thinking
that's also true.
I'm just thinking of the Samantha Powers of the world.
Right.
She's now, like, lots
and
of
that's
her, like,
that's actually what they talked a lot about on that episode, was about her and how she just ignores any, like, U.S.
Yeah.
Atrocities or whatever.
Pause this. Go listen to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, like we said, those folks are experts. I do want to talk, though, now a little bit more narrowly about Human Rights Watch. Kelly, did you read up on this element of it, or
I honestly read the headlines about the Human Rights Watch stuff, but haven't.
Okay, Greg, I'll hand it off to you.
So one of the issues that is discussed extensively on the podcast that we keep referencing, Chapo Trap House, is this idea that Human Rights Watch had that the peace deal in Colombia was unacceptable, when the vast majority of the human rights organizations, especially the indigenous human rights organizations, were on board with this, and also the people, again, like we said, that were most affected by the civil war itself. And they chalked it up to a number of different things. I think one of the main reasons that they claimed to be purportedly against the peace deal was that it didn't meet their standards of legal justice, like we were talking about earlier, and that they were particularly concerned, I think, as Bill was getting at, with the fact that the members of FARC weren't going to face any justice. The paramilitary groups in the Colombian government seemed like an afterthought that they had to say in order to sort of stay above board, but they were not really in particularly good company in terms of voting no on this issue. And I think what we should get into what exactly is going on with sort of the International Human Rights Watch organization being so out of step with the more local human rights organizations on this particular issue.
Sure, and because I think that they were locally kind of aligning themselves with people who are or are borderline fascists. And at that point, that should raise huge red flags.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and you know, there's been a lot of criticism, and I don't want to get into it on this episode because I think we're going to be talking about it in an upcoming one. There's been a lot of criticism about their positions regarding Iraq and Syria, in particular in Syria, basically endlessly banging this drum saying that, along with Samantha Power in the Obama administration, of saying that we absolutely have to start immediate military action in Syria to help Al-Qaeda. I mean, that, like, and I hate to put it like that, but that's what they're advocating for. I know it's more complicated than that, but they're not, you know, because the U.S. is already conducting military operations against ISIS, so they're not talking about that. They're saying specifically that they want the U.S. to go to war directly with the Russian military-backed Assad regime in a manner that supports the rebels who are hardline Salafists who were until very recently, and only then cosmetically not, until recently they were affiliated with Al-Qaeda directly. They were the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. And you know, again, not getting too far into that, but like, that's a weird position to have. Mm-hmm. They had a similar position in Libya. It was very militaristic, and then similarly in Colombia. Now, I think there's been some criticism saying that they maybe get some of their funding from the U.S. State Department, but the U.S. State Department actually backed this peace deal in Colombia, so that put them out even further on a limb. And then the, like, bizarre cheerleading, not only beforehand, but just, like, really spiking the football and getting so excited about the fact that the peace deal was defeated, that's bizarre. Even if you were criticizing the deal, presumably you would say, like, well, that's unfortunate for peace. Let's try to get a better deal or something like that. But the whole thing was just, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. And when you're aligning yourself with President Uribe, the former president who was campaigning against the deal, who's very right wing and, like, really ramped up a lot of violence against the against FARC without much success. And you had people on the other side who were supporting the deal who were literally former hostages of FARC. Like, it's irresponsible whether you're the Human Rights Watch division chief in Colombia or whether you're sitting in Washington, D.C. or London or whatever. It's irresponsible to be going that hard against the deal.
Oh, I was going to note with that is that, can anybody speak to the relationship between the former President Uribe and the general to U.S. political class?
I know he's very strongly aligned with a lot of Republicans.
Yeah.
And I think that a fair number of Democrats were also fairly big fans of his, maybe some of the more conservative ones who I don't think are necessarily in power anymore, because there's been quite a few Democrats on the conservative end who retired in recent years or lost elections. But yeah, I know he has, like, a pretty strong constituency among, like, neocons. And unfortunately, some of the neocons are not even necessarily part of Republican administrations exclusively. There's a fair number of them who are very closely aligned with Hillary Clinton. And I always am careful to stress that, like, I don't call Hillary Clinton a neocon, and I don't imply that she is. But there definitely were people in her administration who were literally self-identified neocons.
Well, there are ones who are still there.
Yeah, some of them are still there. But again, that's the thing that's so astonishing. The State Department spent decades being on the wrong side of the conflict not the wrong side, but, like, they should have been neutral and promoting peace in Colombia, and they didn't. And then now they are, despite having some of those, you know, neocons, hardliners in the State Department still. And then you have Human Rights Watch just out there by itself saying absurd things. And there was some other guy, I don't even remember who, I don't remember if it was an HRW guy or just one of the, like, sympathizers of it, but he tweeted out something like, oh, of course they rejected the deal. This would be the equivalent of the United States giving amnesty to Al-Qaeda and two seats in Congress. which was like a really phenomenally bizarre comparison to make for so many things. Yeah, where that's not a civil war that we're having. And the deal in Colombia, it wasn't even like two permanent seats. It was that FARC's political wing would get two temporary seats for one term in, out of several hundred. And
also keep in mind that, as we said earlier, they're not against arming Al-Qaeda to fight in Syria.
Right. Like that's, yeah, exactly. It's the same people who want to have a military intervention on behalf of Al-Qaeda in Syria who are making this absurd comparison and saying like, oh yeah, like after 9/11, if you tried to resolve it and it's like, what are you talking about? We invaded a country and then accidentally another country in response to something Al-Qaeda did. Like what?
Well, not accidentally.
Sure. But the other thing too is there's a guy on Twitter who goes by the handle Trillburn. Highly recommend people following him. And his response to that tweet about the Al-Qaeda comparison was to make the obvious comparison to the U.S. Civil War. Mm-hmm. And I am of the school that is very hard line on how the aftermath was handled and I would have been in the Radical Republicans camp and promoted Radical Reconstruction. And I think that probably would have worked out better in the long run. But it's definitely undeniable that counterfactuals aside, the United States did grant amnesty by acts of Congress repeatedly per the various post-war amendments. They granted amnesty to almost all of the major figures and all the low-level people within the Confederate, military and government. And many of those people returned to Congress and took up their former Senate and House seats. And that, honestly, that was probably super bad for the country. So I'm sympathetic to the, criticism there. And maybe there was a better way to handle it. But, that is how we handled it. Mm-hmm. And it certainly, definitely not at all good for Black America, how that was played out, in that they were basically not consulted or part of that decision. But if you were part of the white majority at the time, which, was pretty overwhelming at that point, that did really put the war to bed. I mean, I would argue it was poorly handled, but it did put the Civil War behind us fairly quickly after several years of post-war insurgency. That was the price, and that's the thing is there's always going to be this tension between concepts of justice and concepts of political reality that lead to peace, because it's one thing if your choices are justice versus a political preference for ongoing war. It's another thing if your choices are between justice and peace, because if you have a 50-year civil war that you have the opportunity to end permanently, and you're gonna put that war to bed, you're gonna stop the massive killings, things like that, that's a problem. And I think that does dovetail into the Syria situation, again talking about it more in detail on an upcoming episode, but there's a similar argument, and I'm not making this argument, but there is a similar argument that says if your overriding concern is this war is horrible and we must end it, the way to do that most efficiently would be to withdraw all support from all forces opposing Assad and allow him to end the war militarily very fast, possibly by even helping him. And that is a horrible, horrible thought to stomach, which is why many people don't like weighing in on that war in Syria. But if your concern, that is a terribly unjust outcome. And it is true that in that case, he is more responsible. Unlike FARC in Colombia, he is more responsible for the deaths than any other party. So that is not a just outcome, but that is an outcome that would end the war. And once the war is ended, then you don't have people starving and getting bombed all the time and in refugee camps, and people can try to go back to their normal lives. Now, obviously, there's, counter arguments to that, and people would, argue that he would not let people go back to their lives. But there's always going to be this tension in many situations around the world, particularly in, there's lots of research indicating that if you don't wind up a civil war within 6 months or 18 months or something like that, I forget the exact statistic, if it goes past even a very short period of time and there's no winner, then it's just going to be permanently stalemated forever unless somebody, some external force, like, steps in not to win it, but to resolve it peacefully. Mm-hmm. And once it goes past a certain point, you're just going to have to, you know, you're just going to have to resolve it peacefully. Overwhelming military force is the other option, and that's not just certainly, yeah, but it probably results in a lot of people dying. But that can end the war as well. Obviously, I think it's a lot better if you can have an outcome that is more peaceful. The other thing that I wanted to touch on at the very beginning, Kelly made a comparison to Brexit, and I think this is on a lot of people's minds in that it was another razor thin outcome, that it was not predicted to go that way, according to the polling, especially early on. And we did a segment a couple weeks ago on Brexit. Does this seem like yet another example of the problems of resolving things by referendum? Like, on the one hand, they wanted to get mass buy-in so that there wasn't, like, this huge, you know, right-wing uprising, I'm sure, to the government. But, like, is this a bad idea? And we talked also on that Brexit segment about the notion that the response here is not, you shouldn't automatically say we should have less democracy just because you don't get an outcome you like. But there's a question as to the wisdom of putting something on the ballot in the first place. Jonathan, I wanted to start with you on that.
Yeah, no, the one question I would have for that, just to kind of refresh my memory on the background, is why did it go to ballot in Colombia in the first place? I remember I heard before that was something that had been determined years ago, like at an earlier stage in the negotiation process. But it seemed strange to me that a peace settlement would even go to ballot.
Yeah, because that's the puzzling thing. I understand that politically they wanted to get buy-in, but I think in most cases, I could be wrong, but I think in most cases you don't put a peace deal up for a referendum.
Yeah.
Because the people who absolutely show up are the ones who have the most stake one way or the other in terms of a particular faction, rather than, like, it's always harder to get the stake for peace.
Yeah, because, like, as I said, that, like, it would make sense if you just kind of were to get massive political buy-in from, even if it's just so that, like, you link force, so that you basically make it so that no party can really challenge you on that issue, and you just make sure that you have buy-in at the legislative
right, well,
level.
Yeah, because why didn't they get, there's obviously, if the former president was leading the no campaign,
yeah,
there was obviously a problem there.
Yeah.
Like, that they did not, they put it to a referendum without first getting elite buy-in.
Yeah.
And I think that may be the problem too. And I think, is that what happened in Britain as well? Is that they failed to get an elite consensus because you had members of the Conservative Party splitting over which campaign, like, some of them were campaigning for Remain and some of them were campaigning for Leave. And I feel like that seems to be the problem too, is that it's one thing to put it to a referendum. It's another thing to do that without first having gotten everyone on the same page from all the different major political parties and the leaders within that, or at minimum getting them to shut up for the duration of the campaign. If they're not going to campaign for it, you can at least get them to not campaign against it.
Well, Brexit was kind of a Tory civil war in some ways.
Right. Greg, your thoughts on the referendum aspect?
I mean, I know that the ideal is direct democracy, but I think that early on, they realized that direct democracy was sort of unwieldy, and that representative democracy, to have a republic, is better in some ways. And I think that this is one of those major ways that you have the people that you've appointed as surrogates for your best interests go and do their due diligence, which is, I think, one of the issues with both Brexit and the Colombian peace deal, is that the outside of the plebiscite issue is that it doesn't really appear that the surrogates the people have appointed, you know, via democracy, did their due diligence in establishing what the best option was for, you know, their countries.
I don't think they would ever put a ballot question as to whether or not to continue the war. So why is it that the representative leadership, in a representative democracy, you trust your leaders, or theoretically trust your leaders, at least structurally, you are supposed to trust your leaders to decide whether or not to start or continue a war, but then they're going to put it to a ballot question when these leaders have come up with a peace deal, and they're going to, you know, like, that doesn't, you know, that seems like an odd bifurcation there. Kelly,
I've been doing a little bit of reading over here, and it was the Constitutional Court that said it had to go onto the ballot. I'm not exactly sure what precedent they had for that, but sounds like Court got involved and wanted to make sure that the president had the authority to negotiate this deal. I think what jumps out to me, though, is how quickly the vote happened after the deal was reached. So it seems like there was a little bit of sloppiness, or just not making not being totally careful that everybody was on the same page and that they had the people lined up and the votes lined up for it to go the way it wanted. And I think the past month in Colombia, which is really all they had before the you know, accord was reached and the people got an opportunity to vote, has just, I'm sure, been chaos with all of those sort of lies that we touched on earlier today. So I'm not... I guess I don't know enough to say that it was a bad decision to put it on the ballot, and I certainly think that if the results had been different and it had been approved by the people, then we would have said, oh, that's great, and now they have the consent of the people. But I do think that it seems like something that should have been given a lot more thought and managed better from the beginning.
Do you think that this is going to fall apart, or is it going to be possible to maintain a ceasefire while they reassess?
It seems like both parties are, for the moment, committed to holding the ceasefire. And I honestly wonder if that Nobel Peace Prize will go a long way in sort of making sure that this sticks, at least for a couple more weeks, while people sort out the next steps. I think that was a very loud and large signal from the Nobel Committee about the importance of this conflict and the importance of it ending. So I wonder if sort of that softer power of a Nobel Peace Prize will keep people at the negotiating table for a couple more weeks.
Well, I also just wonder, though, like, if you have a no vote on a deal like this, you know, the yes vote is obvious, like, yeah, you're endorsing peace with these details. A no vote, is it because they don't want peace? Is it because they don't like the details? How do you, like, renegotiate a new deal?
And a question I would have with that, so if it had to go to ballot originally because of a constitutional court ruling, what does that mean for the continuation of negotiations? Do they need to continue until they produce a new outcome, which would then have to go to ballot again? Or can they be kind of finished outside of a ballot realm?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn on something I don't know about, but I feel like if this had to go to the ballot, then any deal would have to go to a ballot. Yeah.
Seems like it.
That's the one thing to look at in terms of with ballot question, like ballot initiatives, referenda, etc., that it's, as far as I see it, like that, at least in the U.S., when a lot of those things first came up in states, it was because of, it was out of a way of bypassing, like, sluggish or, like, kind of bought legislatures.
Yeah.
And there's a certain value to being able to go around the legislature and for, like, popular democracy. If although at the same time, like, at least from a U.S. perspective, money can often dictate the results of that, just like it will end up dictating the results of what happens in a legislature. But the more complicated something is, the worse that ends up being as a way of dealing with it.
Right, that if it's a very straightforward thing, like if it was just, we're all going to stop fighting, the end, like that's an easy up-down thing to vote on. If it's, there will be a peace and here are, you know, 60 conditions or whatever by which that is achieved, that becomes very difficult to get adopted. Yeah. And as you said, we see that at the state level. I mean, that's certainly true in Massachusetts, which has a number of referenda this year. You know, one of them is a marijuana legalization question, but it's not just legalization, it's legalization under similar regulations as the process of selling alcohol, and here is what all the different conditions and laws would be surrounding the sale and production and consumption of marijuana. Like, they had to put that all in the thing, And they did that because the legislature wasn't acting. So I guess that's its original purpose. And then similarly, there the charter schools question, you get into all the like, you know, detail after detail after detail about how they're going to do that. Yeah. And it's not just yes or no on charter schools. It's yes or no on specific legal changes surrounding the regime governing charter school. Like, it becomes very complicated, and that becomes very confusing to voters. That increases the likelihood of a no vote, which in that case is fine. And the, you know, but similarly, like, yeah, I can see how it's difficult for that to be adopted in Colombia in this case, because it's like, well, we don't, you know, as I mentioned earlier, how do you know if the people were rejecting the idea of a deal versus the details of the deal?
Right. And I mean, I don't mean to, you know, continue my very, very rudimentary civics lesson, but like, this is what we have elected officials for, right? I mean, we all have our own jobs, our own lives. We don't necessarily have the bandwidth, the mental capacity to work out all of the details of these various things that have been put to plebiscite recently. And so we have entrusted these surrogates that we have elected through a democratic process in order to, you know, act on our behalf and in our best interests, and that they're not either doing it or not able to do it is problematic, and that can lead to, you know, these decisions that are maybe suboptimal.
Yeah, and I think that to go back to the analogy that Jonathan was making regarding the original progressive movement adding these referenda, yeah, the idea was like the legislatures in the states weren't doing anything, and, you know, not only had they been bought to follow a certain outcome, but they, like, there was no alternative. Like, if they just didn't act on it, let alone take a vote, like, you were just out of luck, and that was it. And this idea was that you would have a constitutional provision where you could force something to go to a ballot, whether or not the legislators wanted it. Like, you, or at least they, you know, I think in Massachusetts, they, it still has to get some votes from the legislators in order to qualify. But they, I think they do have to vote on it, right?
Yeah, so the way it works in Massachusetts, I think, is actually done somewhat well to resolve at least some issues. Where in Massachusetts, after the signature collection process, and once you reach a hurdle with that, the legislature is given a certain window of time to respond. So that, yeah, like, there's a certain window that says asking the legislature to act on what's being proposed.
And I know
they can craft a way of dealing with it. And if that solves it for the people who are kind of pushing the initiative, then it doesn't go forward.
Yeah.
If the legislature punts, then there's another round of signature collection, and then it moves forward to the ballot itself. And I think that that actually works well, so that it begins as a process of prodding the legislature to action, and it only would go all the way to the ballot if the legislature is proving that it is seriously not planning to do anything.
Some cases it's also good because it's not necessarily something the legislature disagrees with, but they just don't care to make it a priority to get through. Like, I think that ballot question regarding animal cages.
Yeah, the farm animals, like, one.
That's very popular in Massachusetts, and I doubt that if you polled legislators and said yes or no on it, like, they're probably, most of them are like, yeah, sure, whatever. Like, because there's not even an organized effort against it. So there's not like a, you know, I don't think the lobbying pressure is even that huge. And there's not even a significant constituency within Massachusetts that's like heavily opposed to this or monetarily heavily opposed to this.
All you probably really need to get is a committee chairman who doesn't want to ever bring it up. And then.
Right. And so, but I think there's some like tendency toward like, okay, this is sort of an apathetic like issue for these legislators. They don't care, like, they're not opposed to it like vehemently, but they just don't care, and you can put something on the ballot in that case. But again, like, I mean, you know, who knows, maybe there was broad opposition in the legislative branch in Colombia, but like, it seems like if you had the executive branch negotiates a deal, mm-hmm. and then the legislators were broadly opposed to taking any action on it, then it would make sense to put it on the, and again, we know that the Constitutional Court said they had to, but like, in terms of norms or like, ideally, you would, like, that would be a great situation where you'd say, okay, like, these legislators are just not willing to like risk their seats, you know, because they think they might get voted out if they, you know, endorse this deal. And you can say, like, let's just put it to a broad popular vote. And I guess like that would make sense, but that doesn't seem to be what happened here. I also agree, as Kelly said, if they really only had a month to like whip this campaign together, and I know that the original like tentative deal was back in July of 2015, so even the like outlines of this deal only began emerging a little over a year ago, that's not a lot of time. Like, and it could be that they decided to do it really fast because they thought that they had public opinion on their side and they didn't want the ceasefire to break down before it actually got to a vote, because that is something that is a major risk. Like, you could get FARC to commit to a ceasefire and they might hold it, but can you restrain every single paramilitary group during that time? Because they're going to have a tremendous incentive to disrupt the, you know, the campaign by staging attacks or provoking attacks. And I'm guessing that that may have prompted them to condense the timeline of it, but that seems to have backfired in that they didn't really have enough time to make a genuine case. And I guess also then, as we said, you couldn't really do anything about the timing of the hurricane. That was unfortunate. But I guess my hope is that if the margin was really only like 54,000 votes or something, that's small enough that hopefully everyone doesn't walk away from the deal and go back to fighting. That hopefully the people who wanted to reach a deal say, okay, obviously we need a different way of framing this. And maybe somebody in FARC or whatever will come up with like a list of Fall Guys that they're willing to send to a tribunal or something. I mean, because that's the other way of doing it too, is you say like, all right, we're not going to get the like all the people that we want, but we are going to get some of the worst offenders to get charged with various crimes, and that will be the way to achieve both justice and peace. I guess we'll have to see what happens. And I know that there's been a lot of like kind of alarming talk about, you know, FARC military units redeploying away from ceasefire areas because they had kind of like started, you know, putting their personnel toward like UN disarmament zones and stuff like that, and then now they're like walking away from that maybe, or going back to their sort of more offensive or like broadly deployed defensive positions. That's concerning, but not necessarily the end of the road here for this deal.
One thing, just going back to the former point, talking about Brexit, what's interesting just kind of in terms of a contrast with the Brexit vote versus this one, is that there was simply no reason for like that to formally even have a vote, like vote, even to give it a contrast where like there was something that tangibly happened in Colombia. Whether or not it should go to a vote to have like a kind of a public, like a broad public way, and it's a different question, but there was a tangible new development. When it comes to Brexit,
there was no provoking incident, and it could have just been voted on by Parliament, and it was technically an advisory vote, because they didn't have a way of making it legally binding.
Yeah, it was just an effort of David Cameron to give like to throw a bone to the right wing of the Tories during the election, so that he would and try to, let's say, fend off some of UKIP's kind of growing popularity in certain places by just presenting, let's say, two faces on Europe, where, like, he's not particular. He's saying, like, well, I might not say that we should leave Europe, but I'll give you this vote. Which was just a poor decision on, like, and a completely unforced error.
Right. All right, well, we're going to be out of time for this week. You can continue to, you know, follow on this discussion. We've got the Twitter account is up and running again for Arsenal for Democracy. As AFD Radio. You can also follow Arsenal for Democracy on Facebook. Definitely. That's a good way to get in touch with us. Jonathan, how should people get in touch with you?
Probably Twitter would be best, because I'm at Jonathan Cohn on Twitter. JonathanCohn.
Yeah, so do that, because Jonathan's got a lot more followers than any of us on social media. So, yeah, he's a good person to follow on there. You got a lot of news articles.
Yes.
And, and usually you can also follow me at Bill Humphrey, MA. Greg, you don't talk that much about, like, news stuff, do you? I guess sometimes.
No.
Don't follow Greg. That's a horrifying nightmare. Kelly.
Save yourselves.
Kelly, is there any way that people should get in touch with you or follow you or anything like that?
Just Arsenal for Democracy. That's all the followers I need.
That's true. Yeah. You can go out and check on on the Arsenal for Democracy website, whenever I put up the radio episode, I always link to people's contributor profiles, so you can see the past articles, so you can like find that Columbia article that Kelly wrote last year. All right, so that's going to do it for us. Jonathan, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
Kelly, thanks for coming back to talk about this issue.
Thanks for having me.
And Greg, thank you for being on as well.
Appreciate it, as always.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.